It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got loads lined up today, some teams of 2022 to talk about, the Women's Under-19 World Cup, more Mancad chat, another T20 league has emerged and Virat Kohli is good again. I'm Yaz Rana and with me today is Phil Walker, Joe Harmon and Katia Whitney. Mark Butcher will be joining us later in the show. He insisted that we talked about Mancads, by the way, so you've got that to look forward to. Let's kick off with those teams of the year in the new issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly that is out on Thursday this week. There is the WCM Test team of 2022 and the women's team of 2022. Joe, how was the team selected?
So we've been doing this for like 5 years, maybe, I think, a year off for the COVID year. And each time we've gone to a panel of writers and broadcasters from across the game and asked them to send in their... They're 11. We did that again this year. We got 31 on our panel, which I think is the biggest ever. And then I'll tally up the votes, check them again, and stick the team in the magazine.
So the team is Usman Khawaja, Craig Brathwaite, Marnus Labuschagne, Babar Azam, Johnny Bairstow, Ben Stokes, Rishabh Pant, Marco Janssen, Pat Cummins, Nathan Lyon, and James Anderson. I really like that Brathwaite's in it. I didn't actually pick him myself, but he averaged over 60 this year, 100 in Australia, got that record-breaking knock against England. Only Greenwich, Haynes and Gale have more runs opening the batting for West Indies than him. And he's only turned 30 last month, which I couldn't quite believe.
He's also rather tragically the only West Indian player in the top 50 run scorers for the calendar year 2022. So the 50th comes in with about 200 and something runs. Brathwaite is well up that list and there is nobody behind him. Nobody to help him, nobody to support him.
The feature isn't just that list of 11 players. There are two profiles in particular that are interesting. So Taha did something on Babar Azam and Dan Gallen did something on Marco Janssen.
Taha's was excellent. He went to Pakistan to see family.
Not just for us. We didn't send him out there for this.
Oh, those were the days.
Good freelance gig, isn't it?
Those were the days. Taha's was superb to try and unpick the mystery, the enigma of Babar Azam. And as you say, yeah, Dan Gallen did a very good piece, kind of a pertinent piece really on Janssen as well, where he raised the point that while he absolutely deserves a place in this side, the question has to be whether he will ever feature in another one, certainly in the next 3 or 4 years, because as we know, South Africa aren't really playing too much test cricket.
Yeah, and this cropped up a couple of times through the list. Phil's mini profile of Brathwaite touched on the same things, and it's unavoidable when you pick a team like this that some players have significantly more opportunity to get in there than others, and we don't pretend the team is fair because, you know, we don't control the schedule. England and Australia make up 7 of the 11 this year, and, you know, they've both had very good years, so it's not hugely surprising, but that is also because they play so many more games. And if you're weighing up, say, Chandamal for Sri Lanka, who's got an amazing record last year, I think he averaged over 100, played what we picked as the innings of the year against Australia at Gaul, but actually when you're weighing him up against someone who scored 1,000 plus runs, it's hard to go with him. I actually did in my 11, but he picked up a handful of votes, but wasn't that close to being in the team.
And also Prabhat Jayasuriya versus Nathan Lyon. Nathan Lyon, I think he ended the year as a leading wicket taker, but Prabhat Jayasuriya only played like 3 test matches, but did really well in those 3 test matches.
Absolutely. And again, Lyon just bowled so many more overs. I mean, Jack Leach actually was Lyon overtook him, didn't he? But Leach wasn't far behind. But again, played so many games that in his case, you couldn't really consider him because the average was a bit high.
There was also the cross-format women's team of the year, which was Mandana, Healy, Wolfart, Mooney, Siver, Harmanpreet, Kerr, McGrath, Deepti Sharma at 9, Sophie Eccleston and Shabnim Ismail.
Plenty of batting in there.
Plenty of batting. I was going to say, that's a team that's got all bases covered. I guess with a cross-format team with the World Cup, that's quite... Did you put more emphasis on that when you asked for people to give their selections?
Yeah, well, Alyssa Healy is a decent example in that she didn't actually have a particularly good year. She was injured for some of it, but her performances in the World Cup, particularly see the semi-final and then the final, were so good that she couldn't be overlooked, really. Whilst the men's team felt like a kind of team in flux, perhaps reflecting the change in Test cricket over the last year, with India not being quite so dominant, the women's team felt more like more of the same. There were six of the players that appeared in last year's team as well, just three for the men's. So it felt like there was kind of more consistency there. But there were some. It's good to see some new names coming through.
Nice to see not a ridiculous amount of Australians as well.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I don't know if that... I think there probably would have been one or two more Australians last year. So yeah, it's nice to see that balance.
Mm. Katia, on last week's pod, we talked a little bit about the T20 World Cup coming up, and we kind of assessed where England are compared to Australia and India. How do you see England compared to those two with just a few weeks until the tournament?
Pretty much the same. I think they're the third best team. And I think if you look at the Under-19 World Cup, some of India's players are getting some nice warm-ups in South Africa before the tournament. It's difficult, though, because whenever you go into a women's ICC tournament, there's always this assumption that it's going to be Australia will win it, India and England will fight for the second place in the final. And it's really hard to see this tournament being any different, really. Mm. It feels a bit muted, almost, the build-up to the tournament as well. I guess maybe that is because people are getting a little bit like, well, Australia are going to win it. But yeah, that's kind of how I see it.
I think somehow more than 50% of the questions we got this week were about Mankaz. And I think there was only one since the last podcast, and that was the one in the Under-19 World Cup. Some were, I wouldn't say really interesting, but they're probably as interesting as you can get on Mankaz. But we're not going to read them out because there were so many of them.
Even from your old tutor.
Yeah, that's from a podcast maybe a year or so ago, he got in touch.
Mm.
And also, it was quite football heavy, that one. I think more than half it was about football.
That was the one I read from start to finish.
But as I said at the top, Butch insisted that we talked about Mankad. So here he is on them and the ILT20, the newest T20 competition that's being held in the UAE at the moment. Mankads, yay or nay?
Run outs at the non-striker's end, we ought to call them.
Apparently, the Mankad family came out this week saying that they are now okay with it.
I was basically disagreeing with them. I thought the whole subject is based around you completely disagreeing with it being a 50-50 split between what you think is right and what you think is wrong. So I just thought I'd go against the family. Oh, dear. No, I don't think it's quite right, actually. You know, the man should be sort of sent to cricketing Mount Rushmore for it, because it certainly caused and will forevermore cause an enormous amount of, can I say, piss boiling? I've done it. There you go. and will do forevermore. It amuses me, this whole thing, because I'm kind of ambivalent about it one way or the other. There are some that you kind of were so evangelical about this, including the Indian cricket team, I thought, until such a time as they decided that it wasn't that important after all, if the bloke was on 98 and you'd already won the game, which made me laugh so loud. I kind of, the thing in my head is that the way that people go on about this, you know, batsmen should stay in their crease, da, 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 this is all very simple, it's not an emotive issue. It is, I'm sorry, there's nothing you can do. You cannot turn around people's emotions around whether they think this is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, any more than you can turn around people's emotions about whether you should walk or, you know, whatever the other emotive issues there are in cricket, or whether or not sort of blue passports are going to be more valuable to you than being able to visit and trade your nearest partner's neighbours for the rest of your life. You know, some people will say that it's important, some people will say that it's not. The thing that is most bizarre about this for me is that the argument is coming from a place whereby the game must have been horrendous. The game must have been almost unplayable before when batters were sort of wandering out of their ground with impunity. You know, the absent-minded millimetre for backing up a little bit too early. It destroyed the game as a spectacle up until this point. But now the Cape Crusaders of men's and women's cricket, who are going to whip the bows off as soon as anybody so much as dares to leave their ground, saving a sport that was being ruined, ravaged by this horrendous crime of absent-mindedly leaving your crease. I suppose the other side of it is that I completely understand the argument that, you know, just stay in your crease. You have no right to sort of wander out of the ground. Or if you do, you take the risk of being run out. I understand that too. The thing I do not understand is there's people who then decide to make an equivalence with it being the same as a stumping. Well, it's not. It's not the same as a stumping because the ball is not in play yet. It might be live, but it's not in play. A stumping is affected because the bowler has deceived the batsman into falling out of his ground, or the batsman has made a rash decision charging out of his crease. The man cat has not been affected by skill from anybody else because the game essentially hasn't started yet. And I suppose you could make the argument that fielders shouldn't be allowed to walk in until the bowler's let go of the ball. If you know we are so set on the idea that the ball is live from the moment that no one should gain any sort of movable advantage until the ball has actually left the bowler's hand. So there's another piece of it for you. But I totally agree that people who are taking the mickey deserve to get run out. And I also agree that when Joss Butler got knocked over by, who was it? Was it Ashwin? Of course it was Ashwin. You know, having already given him a bit of a heads up that it was coming, it was the daftest thing that I've ever seen. So, look, I thing is, I don't care about it either way. I just really, really enjoy watching other people get steamed up about it.
Yeah, I guess I have two points on it. One, I think the reason why people get quite riled up about it is because the way the game was played forever, even though it's been in the laws, is that you don't really do that. And it is now coming to the point where it is broadly accepted. And I just don't think people like change. I think it's as simple as that. And then number two, whilst I'm completely fine with it being in the laws and I'm fine with players doing it, I think sometimes when it's been done in the past, you can tell by the players who have done it that they themselves are not fine with it. So, for example, with the Dipti Sharma, Charlie Dean run out at Lords, that was to win a game at Lords, a very close game at Lords, and there were no mass celebrations around it. And Charlie Dean was out of her crease about 50 times before that ball. So if you think it's fine, why don't you do that the first time?
But yes, why don't you do it? Why don't you do it the first ball of the game? You
know? Exactly. But I do think what we're seeing now, and the one in the Under-19 World Cup the other day, for example, is that players are seeing it as a more legitimate way of taking a wicket. So they are doing it the first time they see someone leave their ground. There have been a couple in the BBL over the last few days where players have sought to do it at the first available opportunity. And I'm actually more pro that than I am seeing it not being done until the last possible point.
Not being done until the game is right on the line. Yeah, and I mean, you know, that's always been another sort of side point for me, is that if it was as legitimate a dismissal as any other, then why is it that it only seems to happen when there's a one run to win and the last ball of the game, i.e. that's the infamous example from the West Indies against Zimbabwe back in the Under-19s World Cup. And so, you know, so therein is where it sort of leaves a pretty nasty taste. I think the other side to this is that we're looking at it very much through the prism of professional cricket, or at least cricket that is either being televised or is subject to some behavioural norms, at least the behaviour that comes with the whole game being, you know, scrutinised by a worldwide audience, at least. What is not being talked about is the effect that this is likely to have on village greens on Sunday mornings and Sunday afternoons up and down the country if this starts to become much more the norm. And you can argue to your blue in the face that it's in the laws and you're perfectly within your rights to do so. But as I may have used this analogy before about something else, but it's a roundabout the idea that you're absolutely within your rights to sleep with your best mate's ex-wife minutes after they've split up, but don't complain if you get punched in the face for it. You know, I can just see absolute carnage happening up and down this land and many others if people start doing it as a matter of course in club games, because there, as I said, there's very little sort of regulation in terms of people's behaviour there, and the game as it is played and has been played for years and years and years with sort of, you know, with umpire guys umpiring their own players and all that type of thing, the game is always played on this sort of basis that there will be good sportsmanship, otherwise we will not be sharing jugs in the bar type thing. And if this starts happening up and down the land, there will be blood. I'm telling you of that now.
If the man-cad debate brings out people's emotive sides. The ILT20 tournament in Dubai probably doesn't yet. That's one of four T20 franchise competitions happening at the moment. There's the Bangladesh Premier League, the Big Bash, the SA20, and now this. What have you made of it? Because I've actually quite enjoyed the SA competition. Big crowds, lots of young domestic players who we've not seen a whole lot of before doing really well and actually being some of the stars of the tournament so far. That can't quite be said about the ILT20. That seems to have quite a lot of money behind it. There are no fans. There aren't that many domestic players. The game going on at the moment, I think, has 8 English players playing in it, which is good from a selfish point of view, but it is also quite weird.
The whole thing is pretty weird. On the one hand, the T20 cricket was brought in England, what was it, back in 2003, to kind of bring fans back to the game. And its entire raison d'etre has been to get people into grounds, to get people out there watching live cricket again. And obviously, you do that. The knock-on effect is that television companies want to put it on and it creates revenue, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of, the sole purpose behind it. There was nothing else. There was no other reason. And so when you put on what is now the second most lucrative T20 tournament in the world, the top rate for players there is 450,000 US, making it sort of second behind the IPL in terms of money that can be earned by the players. And when you add to that the fact that you can have 9 overseas players playing in your team because the UAE, it's not, being that it isn't a full member, the stats don't actually count towards anything, but also there is no necessity for there to be any more than 2 UAE players in any one of the 6 teams at any point. And as you rightly say, there's nobody in the grounds. It's kind of like, well, what and who is this for? I think we can take a pretty good guess. It's come from, obviously it comes from TV revenues. It might come from 1 or 2 other places, but it certainly isn't there to please any sort of fan base. And of course, what it is doing is it's sucking players in from, the Super Smash is on at the moment. The Big Bash League has got to have been decimated as it tends to the last 2 or 3 seasons in its second half, with players leaving to go and do other more lucrative things. When you add to the fact that the South Africa thing is happening at the same time as well, you've kind of got this drain of of full members T20 competitions happening at the moment. So not only is T20 sucking players away from international cricket, is starting to suck players away from T20 cricket as well.
And I think you made the point before that when there's this much money around in competitions outside of the IPL, people are increasingly going to view the English summer. English players are going to increasingly view parts of the English summer as that's the time to take a break, actually, because they can make so much money in the winter. And we're not talking centrally contracted players, we're talking players below that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of our shining lights, I suppose, one of the big saving points always for English cricket is the Northern Hemisphere summer. We haven't even talked about Major League Cricket yet in the States. I mean, that potentially is another drain on players from our side of the world, because it is, it's Northern Hemisphere summer, and doubtless there will be an enormous amount of cash flying around in it as well, which will sort of dwarf the hundreds, what is it, 120 grand top rate, whatever, for the sort of top players in the 100. Doesn't even compute. So, I suppose that the other side of it is you could say, well, how is it possible? How is it sustainable that something that seemingly creates no revenue of its own via, fans or people buying tickets to come into grounds or buying hospitality to be in grounds, how does something like that last? I guess it remains to be seen.
Well, cheers for your time, Butch. Catch you later.
Yeah, no problem.
Samuel asks, have the ILT20 organisers forced Rehan Ahmed into opening the batting simply to force you guys to discuss it every week? And then Jamie asks, James Vince, Rehan Ahmed and Ollie Pope, England's Ashes top 3? That is the top 3 for the golf giants in the ILT20. Yesterday, chased down 183. Vince scored 83 off 56. Rahan scored 28 off 17, including one enormous 6.
Ravi Bapara-esque.
I thought that as well.
Kid is going to break my heart into a million pieces.
And then Ollie Pope got a first baller. Earlier in the game, Joe Root opened the batting with Robin Utapa. And they put on 71 for the first wicket. Joe Root scored six of those 71 runs before being run out by James Vince. It is just a bizarre tournament. And I almost feel that if you're not sure what cricket's happening in the world, you can probably make a safe bet that James Vince is going all right in a B-tier T20.
And probably captaining someone. Yeah, he's captaining all the time.
Katia, you did a piece for the website where you worked out that there were 60 English players who have played in T20 competitions over the last month or so. 60.
It's quite a process, I'm not going to lie.
Who put you up to that?
Gardner.
Ben yeah. Gardner, it wasn't me.
No, Yaz wouldn't do that. No. Classic Gardner.
What kind of stood out most for you in that list?
That Josh Cobb is currently the only player in the BPL and all the other English players have left and gone to other franchise comps.
So he's the only one left. Yeah. Okay.
So Andrew Miller, columnist for the magazine, also did his research. He could have maybe saved you a job here. But he estimated that more than 70 players are employed across 9 franchise tournaments this winter. So he says that's 1/5 of the county payroll.
Are we going to have a dispute on stats of how many English players are currently playing franchise leagues then if he says 70?
You and Miller can fight it out between you. but his point...
My money's on you, by the way.
Miller uses that as the basis for a column, really talking about the debt that world cricket owes county cricket. You know, the much maligned domestic game over here is producing so many players. And obviously seen with the IPO auction that English talent is right at the top of the queue at the moment.
Well, there's pretty much then as many English players playing franchise cricket at the moment as there are Australian players currently playing the Big Bash.
Also, I think a pre-season training must be pretty grim if you're left behind as well. I mean, not the best at the best of times, but that's not going to be a fun experience, is it? It must be about 3 people here at Surrey.
You're on the front line of this stuff, Yaz.
Not sure what that means.
what I mean is that, you know, you as kind of joint runner, boss of the website and so on, that it's sort of incumbent on you to be across, as they say, all of these tournaments or the majority of these tournaments. What's your own relationship with this stuff? How do you manage it? How do you manage your weeks and how engaged can you get?
Early days, I am quite into the South African competition.
Well, it's good quality, right?
It's good quality, but so is the UAE one, to be fair. But the big difference is you've got local players you've never heard of who are doing well. Local players who you might have heard of, but you've not seen that much of doing well. And you've got fans, there's good crowds turning up. Whereas this UAE competition, there's basically no one there. There are some people there. It's better than the Abu Dhabi T10, but not a huge amount. Cricket in the UAE is pretty soulless at the best of times, even when there was a World Cup there, even when there was an IPL there. It's extremely soulless for a competition where it's quite hard to work out what the point is, other than for some people who you don't see to make a lot of money. I mean, I can't see how it's sustainable to be paying people upwards of £500,000 for a competition that it just cannot have that many eyeballs.
Yeah, it's pretty grotesque. You're right about the South Africa tournament. That makes sense. In the ecosystem, it makes sense that that should be taking place. And it's unfortunate that it's necessarily sort of foregrounded in South African cricket. But you understand why, due to their financial tribulations. And they have managed to round up some good cricketers there. And so there is a genuine sort of variety of talent that you can easily latch onto. And as you say, there is an atmosphere, certainly the games that I've seen, there's a point to it.
We had a question last week on kind of what are our thoughts on these leagues happening at the same time. I actually don't mind it because you've almost got this mini window now where it's just you get 4 of the leagues out of the way at once.
It's bad news for the ILT20 though, isn't it? Because I think that probably would get a bit more respect and more eyeballs if the South African one wasn't happening at the same time. But there is this ongoing battle to see who's top of the queue because the IPL runs that, but where everyone else fits in. And if you're the second best T20 tournament that's going on at that time, then it's going to be hard to summon a huge amount of respect for that league.
And it's not even just the second best T20 competition. It's the second best T20 competition with significant IPL investment. You've got IPL team names in both of those competitions, which is quite strange.
And my boy Grant Rolofson made his first 50 for the Mumbai team.
Mm-hmm.
The Cape Town Mumbai Indians. Yeah. Is that what they're called?
MI. I think, I'm not sure they're supposed to say they're the Mumbai Indians, but they are MI branded.
Right. MI Cape Town. that trips off the tongue, doesn't it? But anyway, my boy made a 50-odd.
And George Linder, my boy, also yes. of MI Cape Town fame, is going well as well.
Basically our village team, isn't it?
Pretty made much, with Archer and Rashid Khan.
Yeah, but that's the thing, isn't it? When you have those four, there's a real thinning of talent that comes across the T20 competitions that maybe don't pay as much or aren't as attractive or in as attractive places. So whilst, yes, it is quite nice on a freezing day to have some nice cricket on all day, seamlessly, BBL in the morning, ILT20, SAT20, seamlessly, the quality of cricket does kind of get affected.
Mm, definitely.
You've probably talked about this in previous weeks, but Big Bash is reducing its number of games and the time in which it takes place from next year, in large part, I think, because of the talent drain from Australia to the more lucrative leagues now springing up in South Africa and
people
and
losing interest as well, though,
right? As
the 100 works out what it wants to be in years to come, the Big Bash should be a cautionary tale, which is odd because that is what sort of inspired all this in the first place. But, you know, less is more is often the way to go.
Yeah. There are some very fun aspects of the ILT20, though. So Manish writes in to say, you must talk about the fact that the ILT20 has a WWE-style belt for the leading run scorer. Purple and orange caps are dead to me. I want Harry Brook to walk out dressed as Triple H at the IPL. Have you seen this?
No.
So Robin Utapa is the leading run scorer in the ILT20 at the moment.
Show me a picture.
And I'll put it in the reply to the tweet plugging the pod. And he's got this massive WWE style belt.
Doesn't it get in the way of your batting?
No, he doesn't. I don't think he wears it when he bats.
So you just parade it off.
Yeah. I think, not for this week, but for next week, we should definitely have a bit on the pod where we talk about if we were coming up with our own brand new T20 competition, what weird gimmicks would we have? Because like the SA20 on the first commentary stint in the SA20 was Mark Nicholas and AB de Villiers commentating from a bench on the side, so they couldn't really see what was going on, and they hadn't got the audio quality.
It
didn't stop Mark.
Fake beard.
Pardon?
Fake beard. Massive fake beard. For the highest.
For all players?
Okay. highest run score at any one time. You've got to wear a massive fake beard and one of those pretend nose and glasses.
Like
combos.
A pirate costume.
Or a pirate costume. That'll work. Yeah. That'll work. Completely naked? Entirely naked? Save for a jock strap?
Maybe.
You asked.
I was hoping that we'd have more time to think about it next week. So. Anyway, I've got a funny story about the ILT20. So my mum was in Dubai last week, coming back from Pakistan. And so she doesn't know any cricketers. So she won't know who Ben Stokes and Joe Root are, won't know what they look like. But she was sitting in like a hotel cafe and got talking to Dan Lawrence's girlfriend and managed to clock that Dan Lawrence was there for some kind of cricket tournament. And we exchanged a few WhatsApps and it ended with me getting a voice note from Dan Lawrence's girlfriend confirming that she is Dan Lawrence's girlfriend.
Well.
Here is that voice note now.
You're actually playing it?
Yeah.
Hi, Yasin. It's Liddy, Dan's girlfriend. I'm with your mum. She's so lovely. And I'm glad that you know Dan.
It's kind of got a Lost in Translation sort of vibe, that. Two drifters, you know, just in some random, you know, empty bar.
Two very unlikely companions.
But
with something in common. You know,
exactly.
I've interviewed Dan.
Exactly.
We've recently launched our limited edition pure wool cricket sweaters. The sweater was designed by British specialists Crystal Knitwear, who are the official supplier of wool cricket sweaters for all MCC teams and the official Lords online shop. The sweaters are very, very good. Only limited stock is available, so don't miss out on the perfect gift for any cricketer this year. The first ever Women's Under-19 World Cup started this week. It's a T20 competition featuring 16 teams, including some you don't normally see at big ICC events like Indonesia and Rwanda. Katia, your moment of the week is from this competition.
Yeah, Bangladesh beat Australia in the first game. Well, not the first game, on the first day of the competition, which, as I said earlier, everyone's so used to Australia turning up and just dominating everything. It was quite nice to see a rare Australia loss, to be honest. And they didn't just beat them narrowly. They limited them to 130 and chased it down within 18 overs. So it's a proper win.
That is significant.
It is significant. I don't think it's going to be the, oh, Bangladesh are favourites now, Bangladesh are the finalists, but it's good to see that down the pathway there is a little bit of a narrowing maybe of like the gap. But
we saw it with the boys as well, didn't we, a few years ago. Obviously their under-19s won the tournament.
Yeah, I was going to make the point. I mean, they haven't really kicked on as a side since then, have they, as a men's team?
I think you've struggled to say that they had, really. Mm.
Yeah. I don't think it's like massively significant. It's still going to be Australia, India, England, I reckon, as like the three teams to beat. But there have been a few tight-ish kind of games, like Scotland, UAE, was it? Didn't really come to fruition, but it there was a point where it looked like Scotland might beat
Scotland, South Africa as well. They had Scotland, South Africa 45.
It's quite nice to see some tight, close results, not between those three teams. But obviously, you've got India, I've got Shefali Verma, Richa Ghosh, that lot in their squad. You've got to look at the Australia squad and how much WBBL experience that squad's got. England, loads of their players have played in the 100 or at least been around 100 sides. So it's just a massive gap in the experience level between the sides. But that's what this tournament is supposed to address. So hopefully it might take a few editions of the tournament, but I think there are some positive signs that it is going to help with that next level below the professional or international setup in women's cricket, maybe.
I see Shefali Verma's been absolutely smashing it in the couple of games he's played. What do you think about? Is that, because I was trying to work out what I thought about myself, whether it's not quite right that someone who's played at that top level drops down, or whether actually if you're a 18, 19 year old aspiring cricketer from wherever and you get to play against her, what an amazing opportunity and a way to test yourself.
I don't know. I've really flip-flopped on it because it's a really difficult one. I don't know whether, obviously it's great to have these players getting experience against the best players in the world. And I think someone made the point yesterday that if you're looking at current form, maybe Richa Ghosh is the one to have the conversation around in that India side. But I'm not sure, for example, Zimbabwe are bowled out for 25 by England the other day. How much are you learning from being bowled out for 25, conceding nearly 200 runs? I'm not massively sure. But then it's also really difficult to try and put a rule in place around it, because if you say if you've got more than 20 international caps you can't be in the under-19 World Cup, that severely limits the player pool of countries that already have a severely limited player pool. And will that actually close the gap? I'm not sure. England didn't bring, even before they got injured, they weren't going to bring Alice Capsey, they weren't going to bring Freya Kemp, but their players still have a massive amount more experience than other players. So I'm not sure A, how you would implement the rule, and B, whether the rule would be even massively effective in closing that gap. I think India would still be pretty dominant even without Shefali Verma and Richa Ghosh and the like. So it's a really, really difficult issue.
We're looking up yesterday that Catherine Fraser, the Scotland captain, is Scotland's leading wicket taker ever in T20i cricket, senior T20i cricket, and she's playing in the 19 World Cup. I think on your point about comparing how quickly we might see Bangladesh challenge at senior level, I think it is different to a men's under-19 World Cup, because if you look back at men's under-19 World Cups, it can take ages for those players to actually, a lot of those players from one cohort, to break into the international setup. Whereas in the women's one already, you've got current internationals, which you don't really have in the men's one. But even like in the England team, there's no current internationals, but someone like Grace Scrivens probably isn't that far from the England team. Bangladesh are doing well there. Maybe there's the gap between that and the international cricket isn't so big. Just on Bangladesh, I wanted to mention that they beat India in a warm-up game just before the tournament. And one of the players who got runs against Australia, Shauna Akhtar, she only turned 16 this month and scored 78 against India in that warm-up game. Yeah, exciting things from that Bangladesh team.
Yeah, but the whole, it's part of this process, isn't it? Like, women's cricketers start very, very young. What, Catherine Brunt was what, 14, 15 when she came into the England side all those years ago? And like, it's part of the process of professionalism and naturally reordering things so that that doesn't happen, because that shouldn't, obviously there are exceptions, but that shouldn't really happen all the time that teenagers are playing. And now that players who are properly adults have that chance, they don't have to have second jobs and they can play cricket for a living, the under-19 World Cup will take a few additions, but hopefully it will help this process of restoring the balance within international sides, that their players aren't massively too young to be playing international cricket and have that opportunity to develop, and that will increase the standards. So really good signs, I think, so far from tournament, to be honest.
Definitely. Phil and Katia, you weren't on last week's show when we talked about Australia boycotting their upcoming series against Afghanistan. We got some constructive criticism about our conversation on it. Some people made the fair point that we talked too much about Cricket Australia's decision rather than what's happening in Afghanistan and to women's cricket in the country. We got a really well thought through email from Nick on the topic. I'm not going to read the whole thing out, but I'll read out a section of it. Part of the regulations of being a full member of the ICC are that you will have a women's side. Before the Taliban took hold, there were steps being made to develop the women's game. That has completely stopped, and many women's cricketers had to flee the country to escape persecution following the US withdrawal from the country. Does that mean that Afghanistan should be removed from the test game and much of the progress that has been made being undone? I don't know, but it certainly warrants a discussion. Just on that, although Afghanistan have never completed competed in a full women's international, the Afghanistan Cricket Board did award 25 central contracts in November 2020. So progress was being made not that long before the Taliban took over. And obviously that has been completely halted. We're talking about it again before we started recording today, and it is a very difficult situation. We're actually trying to get an expert from Afghanistan to talk about it, but we weren't able to get one in for this episode, but we will continue to try to do so.
It's obviously, it's a massively, massively complicated issue. I went to an equality conference in the summer for the Women's Euros, and members of the Afghan women's football team were there who fled the country when the Taliban took over. And they told their stories and they were harrowing. And I think what is sometimes forgotten in this conversation is that they're not just stopping women from being educated. They're not just, you know, stopping them from playing cricket. These women have been actively hunted through the streets with machine guns. And that should be at the forefront of every conversation. And what really stood out from that, you know, all the statements, everything, was that those players weren't mentioned. They weren't mentioned at all. And whether you think it's right that these matches should be a platform for protest or they shouldn't play them whatsoever, when the T20 World Cup happened in Australia, there were no protests when Afghanistan played. There was nothing. So if you're looking at, would you not play the game or would you go and play the game and protest? It's better to not play the game from my perspective than go and play the game and say nothing about it. Whether you think it's going to make change or not, it should be mentioned and it should be brought to people's attention, and it should be highlighted that it's not right at all.
Well said. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
In the hours before we went to print, a big article that was due to happen didn't happen, and so I brought forward a piece on the explosion in the commercial world of women's cricket. So I brought that forward and did some interviews at the death to try and pull it all together. And it was around the time that news was breaking on the not the women's IPL, because we can't call it that, but effectively the women's IPL. And the numbers were starting to flood out, the sheer scale of what we can look forward to here. And I was writing the piece concurrently while also taking a look at Twitter and seeing these numbers come through. $1 million per match for the broadcast rights has just been confirmed, which means that each team will get about $3.5 million from the Central Distribution Fund in the first year. That's 80% of the revenues, the cut of the revenues.
It's five teams in the first.
Distinct possibility that it will grow from there, because bottom line, money talks, or even money swears, and there is immense interest in this now. And so I was speaking to a handful of female cricketers and a couple of people as well who involved in the administrative side of the game, agents and people at the ECB, and I spoke to Kate Cross and I spoke to Susie Bates from New Zealand, and they are, if you like, they've run the full gamut. And I also spoke to Izzy Wong, who's just starting off in her story. And it was an interesting contrast to speak to Kate Cross, who used to pay her own way, and then speaking to Izzy Wong, who's probably done her fifth interview that week with me and has come into a culture that is preparing itself for this explosion. Right. Beth Barrett Wild, who works at the ECB, said to me, get ready for the shift. And she was talking about the IPL, the women's IPL. And this sense of an onrushing fundamental existential change in what women's cricket, how women's cricket sees itself, I think, is really taking place before our eyes. And again, to talk to Kate Cross and to Susie was particularly interesting, because they both used the word grateful and to describe how they used to feel. And Heather Knight said the same thing to me before as well. that we used to feel grateful for the coverage, grateful for the support, grateful for any remuneration. And now that notion, delivered by the kind of condescension of the establishment, has been eliminated, or it's in the process of being eliminated. And now the women's game doesn't just stand on its own as a great show, but as a hugely powerful commercial enterprise in and of itself. And it's taken a long time to get to this point, but now we are seeing it. We are seeing it right in front of our eyes. And as soon as the Indian market says, right, we'll have some of this, this is when, as Beth says, prepare for the shift. The story is going to go through the roof from here on in. The market is about to explode. And what it means for the likes of Izzy Wong and other young cricketers, you mentioned Verma earlier, truly transformative for these athletes now. It's fascinating to watch it play out and to be on the cusp of it, I suppose, you know. And in British sport in particular, you know, they all mentioned the Lionesses and that epoch change, that shift in perception, but also in the cold, hard economics of what you can do now as an individual athlete. And so all of this stuff was playing out in literally minutes to go before we went to print. And, you know, and the magazine editor there would have been looking at his watch, and I was trying to get it all done. For once, it wasn't my fault. It wasn't Joe. It wasn't my fault. There was other things at play. But then weirdly, Heather Knight texted me literally 2 or 3 hours before we went to print, just as I was finishing this article. And she texted me and she said, can we have a chat next week about the possibility or the inevitability of freelance cricketers moving away from their own central contracts, national board central contracts, and moving to a freelance role, as we're seeing increasingly, obviously, in the men's game. It's not taking long for the women to address the landscape and see that there are going to be some difficult decisions for them too. And it was just odd that the England captain should happen to be asking me this question at that particular point, just as I'm writing this thing. She's doing a master's on it. She's writing this up herself. And she, the most powerful female figure in English cricket, is wrestling herself with these questions about what this means now and into the future. So it's a fascinating time for the game.
Do you think there'll be quite a lot of pressure on DCB / the 100 to significantly increase pay?
Oh, massively, yeah. And Beth Barrett-Wild, who's very impressive, you know, she's been working at the ECB for 10 years, and I've known her a bit for 10 years. And she's lived this story as well, by the way, because she, 10 years ago, she was helping the girls out. She was putting her hand in her pocket. You know, she was fighting for the scraps in an ECB culture that was leaving the door barely ajar, if not fully shut in her face. And that was 10 years ago. Well, now it's a more enlightened organisation, and whether people want to put the boot in or not, that's just the case. And she absolutely, with her ECB hat on, she acknowledges that vast and uncomfortable pay disparity in the first year of the 100, slightly recalibrated in the second, but only just, barely, will soon come to be an alarming chasm. And if they want to protect their assets, if you like, if you want to kind of reduce it to business language, then yeah, eventually this decision is going to have to be taken and they're going to have to get real. I mean, if you want an actual quote, this is from Kate Cross, but Beth was echoing what Kate Cross was saying. Kate said to me, as you've seen with the Lionesses, it does change very quickly, and that gratefulness, in inverted commas, of of getting the opportunity and getting paid will turn into, well, hang on a minute, without women in the 100, have you got a product? Probably not. I mean, you know, the heart and soul of the 100 is driven by the females' game, so it might be time to start paying everyone a little bit more fairly.
Well, I mean, the front.
I mean, that's bang to rights, isn't it?
They used the women's players as front and centre of the marketing of the competition. And last season, to be honest, it didn't really feel like the competition had started until the women's competition started.
No, indeed. And that was another point that Kate Cross made to me, that she said, look, I don't think I deserve 125 grand yet. Being quite upfront about this, that's her position on it. As a top-level England cricketer, she doesn't think to be paid the same amount as, say, you know, Johnny Bairstow. Well, that's a bad example because he didn't actually really play, but you know what I mean. But what they have been begging for ages is equal opportunities, equal chance to play from a very early age onwards. So what you see still with male cricket is you still get all of those advantages from an early age all the way through the pathways, through the academies. It's still, the system is still set up to reward and benefit young male cricketers far more than young female cricketers. And Kate said to me, this is part of an overall fight for equality. This is, one day it's about money, but primarily still it's about equal opportunities, being given the chance to play and being platformed from an early point in your talent path to be given the chance to be the best you can possibly be.
And that piece is in the Wisden Cricket Monthly coming out this week.
You got your first good piece in here? First big piece?
First good piece.
First sizable piece. It is your best piece. Let's be honest. It's your best piece that you've done for us because it's big and it's long and it's excellent on climate change and how it affects the ambitions of county cricket clubs, many of whom are pretty, you know, hand to mouth, down at heel, and how the onrushing climate emergency presses down upon counties and how some can be a little bit more ambitious than others. And Katya pulled it all together. It is your best piece so far.
There's some great quotes in it. Yeah, I read it yesterday. It's a really good piece. We talked about yesterday that there is an absurdity of talking about the climate emergency in the context of Division 2 of the County Championship.
For sure. Will Brown, pod favourite, CEO at Gloucester, brilliant bloke. Looks a bit like Doc Cotton in Line of Duty, by the way.
Oh, really? Yeah, I love Line of Duty.
If you want a nice nugget about Gloucestershire and climate change that wasn't in the piece, if you go to Gloucestershire this year and you get one of the 4 and 6s signs, you can plant them and they'll grow wildflowers.
No.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's wow. Cool. Yeah. They are the hipsters club, as you'd expect from a Bristol club, but they are the hipsters club, Gloucester. If you're looking for a club to support, it would be weird if you are, to be honest, because it's county cricket. It doesn't really work like that, but Gloucester is the hipsters club, the greenest club in the land, as you describe them. Catch it.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
Mine was came from the mother of all thrashings in the third ODI between India and Sri Lanka. India won by 317 runs. That's the biggest win in ODI history, comfortably beating the previous record of 290. The defeat was so bad that Sri Lanka cricket have actually asked the manager of the national team to submit a report explaining how it happened, asking for contributions from the captain, head coach, that's Chris Silverwood, in case you've forgotten, the selection panel and the team manager. They have 5 days to respond, said the statement on the board's website, which described their own team's performance as dismal. So don't hold back, Sri Lanka cricket. But yeah, it was pretty bad.
But Big Chris will just say we just didn't execute our plans.
Well, poor old Chris Silverwood, I looked it up, they've got 2 months before the next game, so he's probably looking forward to some time off, and he's probably had to cancel a holiday or something to
get his report in.
Has he now sparked the most reviews in international cricket?
Anyway, the match itself, obviously, rather one-sided, but the piece that I wanted to pick out from it was Kohli, who scored his 46th ODI ton, his third in 4 ODIs, having gone over 3 years without one. This was his 10th ODI 100 alone against Sri Lanka, which is just ridiculous. Put that in context, only 4 English batters have scored more than 10 ODI 100s across their entire careers against all opposition. And Kohli's probably got a few more to come.
And also, this is his first home series against Sri Lanka for something like 8 years as well. So it's not as if he's actually played them that much.
I actually made me think when I was our list of banned words that we were coming up with, like freak is absolutely one that's so overused. But in the case of Kohli and ODI cricket, his numbers are freakish compared to everyone else's.
Did you do the banned words
last
week?
We did. We'll get onto that later as well. I saw someone on Twitter say how it's quite funny that he switched from not being able to score 100 at all to immediately going back to like peak Kohli ODI mode of you're basically surprised if he doesn't get 100.
And it was I thought the knock itself was actually quite sort of instructive about maybe where he is and what he wants, and that it was 166 off 110 balls, 8 sixes, that's the most he's hit in an ODI, and all of them came in the last 10 overs. This at a time when he's not made the last 3 India T20 squads, and there's some uncertainty whether this is India heading in a new direction or whether T20 cricket is just bottom of the pile for India's priorities this year. I think they may be keeping their options open. It's probably the latter, I think. But, you know, if India's T20 side go really well, you know, Kohli wins the World Cup, maybe is there no need for him to go back to T20? But Kohli doesn't want to give it up, clearly. And it felt like the way this innings unfolded, just going berserk in the last 10, was a little bit of a, look, I can do this. I can do that. Although Sri Lanka did give quite a helping hand. I think there was a sequence of ridiculous drop catches. Yeah, the wheels came off quite badly in that one.
There was some BBL silliness this week. So there's a rule in the BBL where if the ball hits the stadium roof, it's 6 runs no matter where on the roof it's hit.
So you just hit it straight up.
So basically there were 2 instances in one game where the ball went straight up and 6 runs were given.
That's a load of bollocks.
Yeah.
I quite like it.
Moving on.
Do you?
Not really.
No, you don't, do you?
It's just stupid. But I like that it's a stupid thing that makes people angry.
Matthew asks, a career trajectory I'm keenly following after his incredible relationship with Chris Gayle blossoming from his stint at RCB as the youngest ever player to play in the IPL is that of Sarfaraz Khan. He had all the shots even at that time, but was like Ollie Pope on acid in terms of his busyness and not knowing which shot to play at which delivery. Now he's got the best ever first class average after Donald Bradman. He was presumably close to getting selected for the test squad for the Border Gavaskar Trophy. How far can he go? It's a good question. I've kind of been interested by Khan as well. He wasn't named in the India squad for the series against Australia. For people who don't really know much about him, he's 25 years old, made headlines when he was really young for playing in the IPL when he was 16, I think. But 37 games into his first class career, he averages 83. He's got 13 first class hundreds from 36 matches. He's been involved in the India A squad recently, but was overlooked for the squad for the Australia series with Suryakumar Yadav, who's obviously done okay in international cricket recently, getting the nod ahead of him. Suryakumar Yadav is a teammate of Sarfaraz Khan at Mumbai. Sarfaraz averages about 40 runs more per dismissal in first class cricket. So I have no idea how he's going to go. But Shreyas Iyer is an injury doubt for that Australia series now. So it's possible that Khan gets in instead of him. Joe, as we mentioned a couple of times on the show, there's a new magazine out this week. Aside from the stuff we've already mentioned, we talked about the Ponting interview last week. What's in it?
The cover story is a really good piece from John Stern, which is looking at England's win in Pakistan, which actually already feels a while ago. But he's trying to put it in historical context, looking at where it sits in the all-time list of England overseas victories, and also looking at the way in which they played and looking back at Benno's Australia and the fact that entertainment is often more important than the result in some ways. In this case, the result came with it as well. So it's really, it's an interesting take from John. He's done it really, really well. And that's the cover story of the very nice cover that Phil's already shown you. Yeah, we talked about Ponting. We talked about Phil's piece on the business or industry of women's cricket. Just the pieces that I did have just popped into mind. Right? Okay. I've got the Test 11 as well. I've got the Test 11. So
you've got your annual catch up with Craig White.
Annual catch up with Craig White. He's doing well. Good to check in. And so that was a look back at his career in our cricket life series. Good bit of nostalgia in there. He says when he started playing Test cricket for England, he was considered accusations of favouritism because Ray Illingworth was the England selector, obviously big Yorkshire man. Craig White's playing for Yorkshire, had only just started bowling pace about 2 months earlier, and suddenly he's in the England Test side, which White admits he was not ready for, and said Atherton made no secret at all of the fact that he did not want White in his side and would sort of bring him on after 55 overs and say get Lara out when he's on 130, which obviously he did later in his career. Lots of nice stuff in there if you were into your 90s pathos stories of English cricket, and then the turning period of the 2000 series against West Indies. Another interview that I did, which is going to stay in my mind for a long time, was part of the series that I'm doing on being the parent of international cricketers. So I've done the Butchers, I did Mo and Ali's dad Munir, and then this month I spoke to John Holyoake, who's the father of Adam and Ben, who made their Test debuts for England together in 1997. To learn more about where those two came from, where their natural talents lie, whether it was going to be cricket all the way through. But obviously, most listeners will know the story that Ben tragically died only a few years after making his Test debut, and is kind of one of those what-if stories. No one knows what he might have gone on to become. And I was a little bit hesitant about getting in touch with John because it is still, even 20 years later, clearly still raw and difficult things for him to talk about. And he was amazing. I mean, he was so candid. It was really quite an emotional conversation. He actually said at the end, like, I'd been dreading doing this, but I think he felt that there was a bit of kind of catharsism in talking about it. And also, he wants people to, you know, remember Ben and remember how good he was. And it's clear from the stories he tells about Ben as a kid, he was kind of a preternaturally talented kid, amazing at everything he did, took it all in his stride. I spoke to his older brother Adam for the piece as well, who's got a fascinating story in himself and played a big part in English cricket. Certainly here at Surrey, he was, you know, we're talking about aggressive captaincy and dictating the way a game was played. Well, Holyoake did that a long time before that was kind of fashionable in English cricket. So there's lots in there. I'd love people to read it because John put a lot of heart and soul into it. I hope he's pleased with the piece as well.
That sounds amazing. Look forward to reading that one.
One last thing. There's a nice piece from Liam Brickhill, who is a writer based in Zimbabwe. Piece entitled The Team That Wouldn't Die. And he's spoken to Davy Houghton, the inspirational coach behind their rebirth, and Sikander Raza, of course, their key man, their key player. And it's a really encouraging story, rousing story, I think, for the world game, really, that you have this cricketing culture that was on its knees a while ago, not too long ago, mired in all kinds of corruption claims and mismanagement at top level, and a player drain. And now it's thriving again with a beautifully diverse and varied collection of good cricketers. And he does it really, really beautifully. So there's a lot of good writing in this issue, and he does it really well. I want to say again to anyone who's listening still or watching, you can get it digitally. If you don't want to shell out on a print copy, then you can get it digitally. Dead easy, couple of quid, very cheap, very nice, very rewarding. Wherever you are in the planet, on the planet, you can get hold of it.
Yeah, so if you head to wcmdigi.com, you can get an annual digital subscription for 24 quid. That's £2 per issue. And if we can't convince you to buy the magazine, here is an email we got the other day from Steve, who says, I just bought the January edition of Wisden Cricket Monthly, having not purchased a cricket magazine for years. Your mag is a thing of beauty. Okay, you had nice timing. The reason I sought you out is because of the T20 World Cup win and the epic first test victory in Pakistan, but the feature on Sussex is fascinating and the interview with Joe Root is a fabulous celebration of our greatest batsman. So respect to you all, with an extra little nod to chief designer Joe Provis. I realise these things are a team game, but the magazine is beautifully laid out and designed. It could be used as a case study to train any young editor or designer. I look forward to February's edition, given England's continuing exploits. Nice work, team, and thanks for an inspiring read.
I love Steve.
Sounds
I
almost too Steve. Good to be true, doesn't it? But that is a genuine email. Yeah. We did actually receive that email. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, and we should also mention the coaching section as well, which, as people go back to winter nets over the next week or so, a reminder that you can get in touch. How do you get in touch?
Email editorial at wisden.com is the best way of doing it.
But if you want to tweet us as well, it's fine. This month we had Mark Ramprakash on bat speed, Anya Shrubsole on controlling the swing, particularly in swing, problem that you have, yes. And John Simpson on glove work. They are three of the 12 strong coaching team that we've
something
got
like that.
Going.
Something we've got like Lydia that. Greenway, Keaton Jennings, Matt Parkinson, Ollie Pope, Toby Radford, Alex Tudor. So whatever you need, we've got someone who can answer your query.
You can write out an email, you can send in a video, all of that is welcome. 2 weeks ago, Phil asked for words and phrases that you wanted banned. I don't think Phil listened to last week's episode.
He doesn't listen if he wasn't on it. That's the rule.
I do sometimes, bits of it.
Phil didn't get to the end of last week's podcast where we went through the list of banned words. I'm not sure how much it will surprise you, but you were the target of most of them.
Mm, sure.
So I thought we'd end today's pod with a nice message we got about Phil from one of our listeners.
No, don't do that. No, I don't need that. You know, I'm down in the gutter anyway. That's fine. You don't have to do that.
No,
I have. I, I've be, not been unaware of certain targeted volleys in my direction, and that's fine.
I think there's a lot of warmth in those volleys.
No. But there was one which I will defend to my deathbed,
yeah.
And it's strumming, because it's a catchphrase. It's a catchphrase, right? It's also a beautiful word, and it does the job succinctly, and I'm not always known for my brevity. Strumming, I will protect and cherish until the day I die. Whoever sent that one in,
this did crop up last week.
I am going to read out this nice
email. It's a catchphrase.
So this is from Salman, who on YouTube commented, "Great pod as always, guys. I'm a doctor and a sports tragic from Lahore, and your weekly podcasts are the thing I look forward to the most the entire week. I discovered you guys during the early days of COVID and have been hooked ever since. Phil's description of Babar Azam's century after the New Zealand game in the 2019 World Cup are still my favourite words anyone has ever said about a cricketer. I listen to it
ludicrous.
At least once a month."
Thanks, mate.
Phil's my favourite, and it would be nice if you guys could feature my comment in next week's episode. It will give me more motivation to write.
Well, did you say emails. Salman?
Yeah, Salman.
Salman, you're one of your own, mate. One of your own. Thank you, my friend. What a glorious
And if people haven't have started listening to the podcast since then, so we did World Cup dailies in the 2019 World Cup, and our staffing schedule was a little bit all over the place, so we had to get creative of how we were doing certain episodes. So after the Babar Azam century at New Zealand, I think Phil did like a 5-minute monologue at the start of one episode about Babar Azam's century before he talked to someone else. I can't
but
really
he did
remember.
Have a guest. This was purely optional.
Was he?
Yeah. No, I did. Andrew Alderson, the esteemed New Zealand cricket writer. And I said to him, it's not impossible that I had taken a drink that evening. It was a Saturday night. And I said to him beforehand, I've got a thing on Baba. Do you mind if I, you know, indulge me? And he said, you know, New Zealander, so he's very relaxed about it. He said, that's fine.
Nice man in cricket journalism. Yeah, he's lucky you had him on with you.
He's a joy.
I think a lot of people wouldn't have put up with that.
I think that's enough for today's show. Cheers,
plenty.
Katia. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll be back next week. Podcast Network.